a storm.
I'm Peter.
And I'm Felice.
Welcome to our travel podcast. We're specialist travel writers, and we've spent half a lifetime exploring every corner of the world.
So we want to share with you some of our extraordinary experiences and the amazing people we've met along the way.
There's an alligator that literally just came out of this water hazard, frightened the bejesus out of me. I was scared shitless, Felice.
Yes, you've guessed it. Global golf. That's what we're talking about this week. Our guest is renowned golf commentator Farhad Haydari. Farhad's a leading authority on the game and no mean amateur player himself. Not many of us can shoot 72 at St Andrews. Farhad, golf has been a huge part of your life since you were a small child. Where did it begin for you?
Peter, it began for me when I was about 13 years old. My parents were living at the time, as they are now, in a place called Westchester County, which is just north of New York City. It's the Surrey of New York City, if you will. It's dotted with golf courses and some incredible golf courses, including down the road from us, Wingfoot Golf Club, which just hosted the U.S. Open. And so having had this incredible tableau, if you will, of incredible championship golf courses, it was natural for me just to sort of get out there and just sort of hit the ball. I had a huge amount of tennis aptitude when I first started, but the problem with tennis was that you needed to find the partners to play with that were of the same competent level. Whereas with golf, you could play with whoever, you know, happened to rock up.
Can you remember that first time you played golf?
The first four or five times that I played, it was at a driving range because, of course, some of these rather more elite golf courses and golf clubs didn't like to have a young 13-year-old showing up and taking divots out of their beautifully manicured turf. So I was on the driving range for a good long while before I made my first foray. And I remember exactly where it was. It was a place called Ridgeway Country Club, which is sadly no longer in existence. It's as unfortunately what's been happening in the States. A lot of these golf courses have been going under. Properties have been changed into schools and the like. But yeah, it was Ridgeway Country Club in White Plains, New York, where I played my first round of golf.
So were your parents players as well?
They were not. In fact, my parents have no sporting aptitude whatsoever.
And golf is one of the most popular sports in the world, isn't it? 60 million people around the world play regularly, so it's very popular.
I call it a game, but a lot of people would take exception with that. They do call it a sport, and at the absolute highest levels of the game, it is a sport. You know, you're walking considerable amount of distances every day. The mental pressure is huge. I mean, if you play golf at a competitive level, which I have done on an amateur level, you play 18 holes, and with the mental concentration, you're absolutely shattered, whereas you could go for, you know, a 25-mile run, and you'd feel more energetic after that. So golf is a taxing mental game, but it's a great game and it gets people out and it's a social game and you're able to deduce the moxie of a person after 4.5 hours you play with them. You really get a measure of who they are and how they comport themselves, both from a sportsman standpoint, but also from a human standpoint.
So you won a golf scholarship to university.
I did. It was more of a country club than a university. It was a college up in New Hampshire, and I played a lot of golf up there as well as tennis. And there were a lot of more adept competitors that we had on the team than I was. But I played a huge amount of golf up in college. And then I had the great fortune of parlaying that into a stint covering the PGA Tour. And so I was traveling around with the professionals for a while and making their acquaintances as long before social media and the intrusiveness of cameras and all that. And so you were able to hang out with these guys in the locker room and take away some lessons from them and travel with them and go to wonderful, wonderful places and see the world. And, you know, my history with golf just sort of snowballed by complete happenstance.
So how long did you do that for with the PGA?
I did that for 4 years.
You must have met lots of notable players.
Absolutely. I mean, I traveled with Nick Faldo down to Jamaica, and, you know, he and I were really well acquainted, and Fred Couples and I became quite friendly, and there were many, many others. And again, this was in the day where there wasn't that whole gotcha mentality where everything was ending up online. And so they could let their hair down and they could be more extemporaneous and speak about things, which, of course, now they would not be able to do because they're all so guarded and shielded. And back in those days, there wasn't this whole level of a team, if you will. All golfers, professional golfers nowadays have a team, you know, whether it's a sports psychologist or a nutritionist or a trainer, and they travel around in teams and on private jets and the rest of it. Back in the days, they were just showing up in a Winnebago, an extended van, and you know, they were changing the diapers of the kids off the back and then taking the shirt off the, you know, it was a completely different game. And so the journeymen who were on the tour were much more down to earth. Everybody from John Daly to the rest of them, they were much more amenable to chatting with people that they saw were part of the firmament of golf, even though we were on the outside of the ropes, as they like to say, covering the game from the outside in.
So was there anything in their characters that they had in common? Is there something that makes a champion golfer?
Well, there's a huge difference between club golfers, let's say, club professionals, and touring professionals. And that's the mental game. I mean, most of them can hit a ball far and long and straight and have the aptitude to be able to play the game to a pretty high standard. But what separates the elite golfers, you know, the professionals, from the club players, if you will, is the mental game and that incredible ambition and drive that they all seem to share, that they can conquer the world and they can absolutely conquer the field, i.e. their competitors during a given week.
So is the one great champion who stands out for you?
Well, I've been very, very lucky, Peter, to have met and spent a lot of time with most of them. And Jack Nicklaus and I spent a fair bit of time together over the years. And he was not only a gentleman, and he remains a gentleman, was the first of the modern day golfers to parlay his on-course successes, which were innumerable and unimpeachable, to off the golf course. So he created a whole architectural design element. He created his own line of clothing and branding, and many others followed. Greg Norman with his great White Shark Enterprises. But increasingly, the game took sort of a pivot to off the golf course. What would you do when you were a little bit old and frail and you weren't able to hit the ball as long as the other competitors could do? And how were you going to leverage your notoriety to off the golf? And so what happened was some of these notable golf professionals ended up becoming ambassadors for the game, taking the game to regions and countries and places that didn't have golf. So, for example, Greg Norman very famously went to Brunei for the first time and created a golf course there. He's the first golfer who developed a golf course on mainland China. Nick Faldo also did the same thing. And Jack Nicklaus, of course, he was in the vanguard of that. He started developing a very, very important and sophisticated golf course architecture, a consultancy and firm, and his two sons got involved with that as well. So it was all about how do you make the game much more accessible to the rest of the world, taking it away from the British Isles and the US, where it was thriving, and get it more active in Europe, in places like France and Italy that didn't have the game to a readily, you know, level that we now have.
So presumably the whole process of a golf course architecture is incredibly sophisticated and difficult. I mean, how do you go about taking a bit of land and just turning it into a championship golf course? I mean, that's not easy, is it?
It's not, but these guys have the vision, and the vision that they have is incredible. I mean, back in the day, the heyday, the golden age of golf architecture, we started in the 20s and 30s, you had people, historically significant golf architects like Harry Colt and Alistair McKenzie in the UK, and then you had people like A.W. Tillinghast and Donald Ross, who were from British extraction, but they went to the US, and they were met by developers and proprietors who said, listen, I've got this piece of land, can you see a golf course? And of course, the pieces of land didn't, you know, we didn't have the population density that we now have in certain parts of the world. And so they were able to mold these incredible parcels without having to move too much land, as they call it. And so it was a much easier proposition, let's say, than it is now, where we're all hemmed in and land is much more expensive. But, you know, they have their artists and they have this incredible vision. And nowadays you have this next generation of golf architects, everybody from Tom Fazio to Robert Trent Jones Jr., Bobby, who was the son of the original. And then, of course, players became architects. Everybody from Greg Norman to Nick Faldo to, as I mentioned, Jack Nicklaus. And now you have this next generation of younger golf architects who are coming on the scene who have never played the game professionally, but they have a great eye for it. Everybody from Gil Hans to Tom Doak to Ben Crenshaw, who, of course, played with his partner, Crow. So you have these golf architects who are being sought after by proprietors who are, let's say, much more foresighted than a lot of other people are. And they can see a particular parcel of land and they can say, you know what, I want this to be turned into a golf course that is going to last 200-300 years, as some of these original classics have.
So is there a particular type of land that's good for golfing? I mean, like desert or mountains? Or
seaside, links?
Well, as it happens, all those places are particularly great for golf courses because of how far agronomics has come along. You know, back in the day, you couldn't create a lush, grassy golf course in the desert, but now you can. Technology has come such a long way. Seaside golf courses, coastal golf courses, links golf courses, as Peter just mentioned, Felice, are the most heralded, of course. But a lot of people don't want to give those up. And the most spectacular, notable seaside golf courses have been opening on the Pacific Northwest of the U.S., as well as in Nova Scotia, and some in New Zealand as well. But nowadays, you can pretty much develop a golf course anywhere. And some of those desert courses, which a lot of people find tricked up because they have water fountains and waterfalls and the carries over water, all of which are artificial, look spectacular and they're a great challenge for the game of golf, but they're not as true to the essence of the game as some would have you believe.
So which brings us on nicely to what are your favorite courses in the world that you've played at or spectated at?
I've been very, very lucky because I've played some of the most incredible golf courses in the world, everywhere from Cypress Point, which is one of the golf courses at Pebble Beach, to all the ones up at St. Andrews, to places in Asia. The one that really does stand out for me is a place called Pine Valley in New Jersey, which many people say is the most private of all the golf clubs in the world, and it is. I've played Augusta National, which is a great golf course, and many, many others. I played one which I'll never forget, called Camp Creek down in Destin, Florida, which for me just sort of stood out because it was so beautiful and so much fun to play. Lots of water carries and a prevailing trade wind. But again, you know, places in Hawaii. I mean, there's so many incredible golf courses, multifarious locations all around the world. And then there are these destinations that are popping up where one golf course gets developed and then the developer says, you know, these avid 36-a-day types, as we like to call them, golfers who play two rounds a day, we need another golf course for them. And so what happens is you have a cluster of golf courses that develop in random places in the world. So you now have that obviously in St. Andrews. They've just opened a new golf course in St. Andrews this year. But you have it also in the Midwest of America. And you have it, for example, down in Sicily, Verdura, where there was one golf course. And Sir Rocco Forte decided, you know what, to attract and unveil the keen golfers, let's put another golf course. And then there's another place, you know, in Greece, Costa Navarino. It's a resort that already has two golf courses and they're building two more. So if you can create a destination, if you can create a cluster of golf courses that keep the keen golfer, you know, engaged and enticed, you know, you can spend a week there and be really, 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 you know, engaged with the golf.
So does that mean that a keen golfer would get bored playing the same course every day?
Yes. I mean, you know, club golfers, you know, higher handicappers do play the same golf course every day. You know, they're a member of a golf club and they go there and they, you know, play on Wednesdays and Saturdays or Saturdays and Sundays, whatever the case may be. But there's a class of golfers who want to test their game on these beautiful, totally different tableaus of golf. And so they will travel far and wide to put their game through the paces. And that could be anywhere from a links course, as Peter mentioned, or to, you know, a desert course, to whatever the case may be. And the great thing about golf is that it bridges all these different things, architecture and the arts to geography and topography, to location and travel. And so it's a great proposition, if you will, for somebody who has that, who's caught that bug, let's say.
Yeah, because most golf clubs have something else for the non-golfer to do. Like some of them might have a swimming pool or tennis courts or...
Yes, the country clubs, yes. And a lot of purists say, you know, I don't want to be a member of a country club where, you know, you have tennis club, you know, tennis courts and paddle courts and the kids are swimming. You know, I want to be a member of a golf club. But, you know, I believe that... what you should do is open up the game to more and more people. And so if you have a country club and the kids are jumping in the swimming pool, but then, you know, can come out and play with their father a couple of holes or walk and be around the game, that opens the game to more and more people. Because as you mentioned early on, Felice, there are 60 odd million people playing the game. But unfortunately, over the last few years, and COVID issue notwithstanding, many of these golf courses in less traveled parts of the world have been closing. So the municipal golf courses, those which are run by local governments as a service, as a recreational element for local people in population spots, whether it's Los Angeles or New York City, et cetera, are closing. Because as you know, with golf, there's a huge amount of overhead as it pertains to operations and maintenance and the rest of it. And so it's not a... it's not a maintenance light pursuit where you're going to put a tennis court and you make sure it's painted and the net's not raggedy. You know, with golf, it really does need a huge amount of care and attention. And so a lot of these golf courses are unfortunately going to the wall. As I mentioned, Ridgeway Country Club up in Westchester, north of New York City, where I played my first game of golf. It's been turned into a French school.
Do golf courses come up against problems with the environment, with people who are anti-golf courses because of the water and things like that?
Yes, they do. Yes, they do, Felice. Because what has happened in the last few years is obviously the environmentalists have seen that there is a huge amount of pollution and runoff from golf courses with the pesticides that they use. However, also concurrent with that, golf courses and the superintendents who run the golf courses have become much more creative in the ways that they're applying the chemicals to make sure that they are in keeping with the local surroundings. And again, going back to the technology factor, there is a huge amount of technology that's going into agronomy that is making golf courses much more sustainable environmentally than they used to be before. And so whether it's introducing worms that can reseed, you know, the grassy areas, or whether you have wild runoff areas, or whether you have natural fescue and grasses that can frame golf holes rather than the manicured grasses that you need that would take a lot more pesticides and herbicides and the rest of it, golf is becoming much more environmentally friendly than it used to be, even though there are still to this day, I think perhaps rightly, perhaps wrongly, so detractors out there.
Of course, there are quite a lot of golf courses in the world in wilder places, particularly in Africa, where there are lots of natural hazards that you wouldn't find in America or in Britain, say, like getting close to a crocodile on the green.
Absolutely. Or rattlesnakes or scorpions and the rest of it. I mean, I remember I was playing one time in Florida, and there was an alligator that literally just came out of this water hazard. I won't use an expletive because it's a family podcast, but yeah, I mean, it frightened the bejesus out of me. But no, you know, in Australia, you got rattlesnakes, you know, going around and cobras and the rest of it because you're out there. I remember playing this golf course in New Mexico on a Native American reservation called Tamaya Resort. And I was going along with a professional at the time, and he said to me, he said, Farhad, I wouldn't foray too far from the edge of the fairway. We got rattlesnakes here. I was like, okay, you know, we'll just leave that ball where it is and, you know, drop one here.
So what did you do when you saw the alligator come out of the water hazard?
I was scared shitless, Felice, to underscore and underline that. No, it was frightening. And, you know, if you Google encounters of the wild kind on golf courses, you see it all the time. You know, people reaching in to try to get their ball out of a water hazard, not realizing there's a giant crocodile or alligator in there. So,
I'd never thought of that.
And then, of course, if you play in certain parts of the world, up in the northeast of the U.S., you've got bears and cougars and, you know, the rest of them. I remember one time playing up in New Hampshire at my home course, which was called the Shattuck. And during deer hunting season, you had to wear all orange golfing kit because, of course, you would stand out to the hunters because, it was deer hunting season. And it was my freshman year, and I didn't, you know, I wasn't dialed into this fact. And I'm playing the first hole, and between the first green and the second tee, this guy comes out of the woods in full camo gear, all black with a night scope and a bow and arrow that could take out a, you know, 18-wheeler or a lorry. And he just looks at me, he's like, play well. And he just crosses the fairway. And I'm like, oh my God. So because of course, deer hunting season, these people are, you know, murdering hundreds of animals and I'm out there trying to hit a golf ball. So there were those perils as well.
And you're becoming the prey, the target as well, too.
Well, let's hope not. I mean, I've lasted this long, Peter, so I must be doing something right.
So what about equipment and clothing? Do those change quite frequently?
Yes, equipment has changed, and it has changed considerably in the last 15 to 20 years, and to the dismay of many, many people. A lot of people think that the golf equipment and the strides that the manufacturers have made is rendering many of these golf courses that were created by the originals during the heyday of architecture in the golden years moot, because they are able to hit the ball further and really, really decimate these classic golf courses in a way that the architects could have never imagined. And from some quarters, there are people who are trying to dial back how far a golf ball travels to make sure that these golf courses that were beautiful and fantastic and are a challenge to most amateurs are not rendered completely pointless. And of course, technology keeps moving on. The golf clubs are becoming much more forgiving, which has made the game for amateurs much more pleasurable. Back in the day, you know, you would have a hickory shaft with a persimmon head and you would be swinging it and the ball would bumble down the fairway. And now you've got titanium heads with graphite shafts that, you know, anybody can hit 200-300 yards. And so the game is much more pleasurable, but there are some strides being made to rein in some of the exceedingly powerful advances that technology has made. And of course, then the equipment manufacturers have to adapt to all this. And equipment manufacturing is a very, very expensive proposition. Everything from research and development to marketing, et cetera, et cetera. So we have seen that the number of golf brands, equipment brands, has shrunk. And now we have a handful of major golf brands which are monopolizing the golf sector. And having said that, there are some people who are huge devotees of the game joining the ranks of golf manufacturers, most notably a gentleman by the name of Bob Parsons, who was the founder of GoDaddy, the web registration. And he was such a massively, massively keen golfer that he decided he's going to pour a huge amount of money to create his own golf brand. And so he launched a company called PXG, Parsons Extreme Golf, a few years ago. And his golf clubs are absolutely brilliant. And they're very, very forgiving. And they're very expensive, unfortunately. But again, he's joining the fray and saying, you know what, there is space for other manufacturers to be out there, and we want to join the top tier of said manufacturers.
But none of these strides, progress in the manufacture of equipment, help people like me standing in total shaking with fear on the first tee at Sunningdale or somewhere with a queue of people waiting to go behind me, knowing that it's almost impossible for me to get that ball into the air in a straight line.
Well, Peter, you and I then need to go out for a full day clinic where I will rebuild your swing. And, you know the old adage goes, we need to break you down to build you back up again. But before too long, you'll be hitting the soaring golf ball off the first tee down the middle of the fairway of Sunningdale, old or new, as the case may be. And you'll vanquish those fears. But yes, I mean, seriously speaking, those first tee jitters, as they call them, are very well founded. I mean, I can't remember how many times I've played with amateurs who get up there and they literally are shaking. And I'm like, dude, it's, you know, relax. It's not brain surgery. You know, you're not trying to remove a tumor. You're just trying to hit a white golf ball. I've been very, very lucky that I've played in a boatload of pro-ams. And pro-ams, for the listeners who don't know, are the professional amateur days that precede the Thursday start of a tournament. And so you have sponsors who invite their, you know, their top benefactors or friends of the tournament or friends of the brands or sponsors to come and play a practice round with one of their pros. And so the pros are getting the measure of the golf course before they play their tournament starting on Thursday with a couple of practice rounds on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. And I played in a couple of those most recently last year at the BMW Championships at Wentworth with one of my mates, a professional golfer out of the UK called Paul Casey, who you may have heard of, with the head of Rolex as well as his agent. And, you know, we had 55,000 people out there and lining the fairways. And my wife was walking along with us inside the ropes and she said, you know, how are you managing to do this? How are you managing not to shank it, you know, into the, you know, the face of grandma sitting there? You're used to it. But people are petrified. And there are instances of amateurs, unfortunately, having an errant shot during a pro-am or on their Tuesday or a Saturday roll-up at their local golf club. At the end of the day, if you don't have that incredibly precise level of concentration over every golf shot, things are bound to go wrong because it's such a finite, I mean, the ball is just sitting there. It's not like tennis where the ball is coming at you and you have to react. The ball is just sitting there and you're just there with your own thoughts, with this thing staring at you and you've got to hit it. And it sounds simple, but as most, you know, golfers will tell you, it's a lifetime pursuit in trying to do just that. And you go out there and you try to do something different and you watch something or you read something. You know, back in the days, we used to put in VHSs of Jack Nicklaus's My Way to try to play the game. But nowadays, you know, with YouTube and all Instagram and the rest of it, so much information is out there to be able to make the game much more accessible so that when you do go and stay, you know, stare at that white ball in front of you, you know, your knees are not shaking and you can hit that soaring shot, Peter, into the air on the first tee at Sunningdale.
Well, I look forward to it.
Well, you mentioned Wentworth because that's where I came in because my mother was a member. And so throughout childhood, I went to Wentworth every weekend, but I was never allowed to play. I had to stay by the swimming pool in winter or I can't remember what I did in summer. Sometimes I had to help caddy, but I was never allowed to play.
And that's one of the great disservices that has been done and was done to women for a great many years in the sphere and the game of golf, where women were subjugated to being sort of second place, you know, players, let's say, at many, many golf clubs. And then, of course, there were the golf clubs that didn't even allow female members. And those that did had very restrictive times for when the female members could play and when women could go out. And so it made it very, very difficult for women to get traction into a game which was naturally perfectly a fit for them. And so unless you allow a much more inclusive, let's say, milieu for women to join and to play and to feel welcomed, you're never going to have women in great numbers of a certain caliber being able to play the game. But the Wentworth of yesteryear is a lot different than the Wentworth of today. The course is now under new ownership. The golf course is absolutely bonsai perfect. And I'm very lucky that I get to play there three or four times a year with friends who are members.
And do you think golf clinics are a good thing? Do they vary? Are some of them very good and some of them a waste of time? Or should
they do vary? I mean, this one of the great things about golf is that you can go off and have a clinic or have a multi-day academy like we used to do back in the day with tennis. You know, back in the day when tennis was on the ascent, used to go down to Florida and Chrissy Everett had her academy and Nick Bollettieri had her academy and you could play all these different, you learn about the game of tennis. And golf is less so organized, but most golf clubs and most golf resorts have a huge teaching program where they have their director of golf and they have a handful of pros who can teach and can teach the game now because of all the technology that we have in the game with feedback, everything from telemetrics to video to, you know, everything, which measure everything from, you know, your ball speed to your dispersion rates to your swing speed to your positioning. And you can look at it and you have instant feedback. So it's a lot less ethereal. It's much more tangible. And you can see what you're doing right and what you're doing wrong. So learning has taken on a whole new dimension. And I would say you can learn a lot faster than you used to be able to, you know, reading a golf magazine as we used to do back in the day or trying to emulate Jack Nicklaus on an old VHS.
And how fit do you have to be to play golf?
As was demonstrated by my dear old friend, John Daly, who was a paragon of unhealthiness and obesity, you don't have to be healthy at all. But in playing the game, it does make you a much more healthy individual because you are, if you're walking, there are certain places in the world, the States notably, where when you play some of these longer destination golf courses, they insist on you taking a cart or a golf buggy just to keep the pace of play up. But in a lot of other places, the British Isles, some places in Asia, where walking is, you know, not only not frowned upon, encouraged, you can become quite fit. But then you go to places like the Middle East where, you know, if you're playing during the day and it's 110 degrees, you'll have a heart attack and need a defibrillator. So there you'll have to play the golf courses with a golf buggy and a cart. So it depends where you're playing the game.
Jimmy Connors once said to me that there comes a moment as a sportsman when just occasionally the ball coming across the net is the size of a football and you simply cannot go wrong. Have you ever had a round of golf when you felt like that?
I have. Jimmy, of course, would know because Jimmy was considered one of the best returners in the game of tennis until Andre Agassi and Jim Courier came along. And for golf, yes, the analogy that we make is that the hole looks the size of a bucket, because everything you're putting will drop in the hole, and you have one of those outrageous days. I've been very, very lucky in the in the past couple of years that I've played some of my great golf. I was very lucky. I was at the Dunhill Championship Pro-Am up in St. Andrews, and I shot 72 there. I've shot a couple of more rounds in the 70s in the last couple of months. So I'm very, very lucky in the sense that I've got my wits about me, and I'm mentally in a place where I can relax and playing with a handful of great, great chaps that I play with on a weekly basis, where we're all comfortable. We're not, we're not trying to be showy. And that level of comfortabilitality, if that's even a word, a faux polysyllabic word, leads to you playing great golf, because it puts you at ease. You're not stressed out. I remember one time playing a game of golf with a chap who, when we stood on the first tee, he said to me, "These are the last words we'll exchange until the 18th. And sure enough, we didn't speak at all for the 18 holes. And at the end of the 18 holes, he says, "That was a great game. Let's do it again." And I'm thinking to myself, I don't ever want to look at you. I don't ever want to see you. In fact, I'm going to punch you, you know? He just took it so seriously.
So you're an editor and journalist as well in the rest of your life when you're not playing golf.
I've been an editor and a journalist. I've been very, very lucky in that I've had a multitude of different careers. In my current remit, I work very closely with NetJets, which is obviously the largest private aviation company in the world, producing magazines and content for them. But I also have my own consultancy, which is an entity called the House of Haydari. And it's an entity that provides advisory services for C-suite individuals, blue chip companies on a whole slew of levels. It's going from strength to strength. If you're listening to this, you should follow me on at Mr. Farhad Haydari on Instagram, where there's a lot of golf content, which you will be curious about.
Can you just spell out your name?
Farhad, F-A-R-H-A-D, and the last name is Haydari, H-E-Y-D-A-R-I.
Farhad Haydari, many thanks for appearing on our show, and we wish you the very best in the future with your golf and all your other projects.
Thank you very much indeed, Peter. It's been great being on with you and Felice. Best of luck with the podcast, which we'll all be listening and tuning into.
That's all for now. If you've enjoyed the show, please do visit our website, actionpackedtravel.com, or subscribe on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, or any of the many podcast platforms. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love you to sign up for our regular emails too, at peterandfelice@gmail.com. That's peterandfelice@gmail.com.